I'm Steve Hayward. This is Off Topic.
I'm Kathy Jaffray. It's been 40 years since human beings first set foot on the surface of the moon. But what's been happening with space exploration since that time?
This week on Off Topic, we bring you the ungoogleable truth about the space race, about the connection between space exploration and space exploitation. We talked to astronaut Sandy Magnus about life on the International Space Station.
Don't take for granted the ability that you can go outside and you can feel the breeze on your face.
We talked to science fiction author and NASA scientist Dr. Jeffrey Landis.
Well, of course, there's the future of my dreams and also the future that we're likely to see.
We speak to astronaut Leroy Chow.
Once you've got the technology mature and the commercial market sees the potential there, they're going to go and try to do it, which is what's happening.
And author and space activist PJ O'Rourke tells us a little bit about where we've been, where we're going. Stay with us. Of all the months in which to teach, Professor Stillman believed May to be the worst. Students, on the cusp of graduating, on the edge of the rest of their lives, were often easily distracted. They spent class staring out the window instead of listening to him lecture. They were there in body, but the rest of them was already gone. "Let's have class outside," suggested his student Henry. "Yeah," said another student. "Come on." "Like at Coachella," said a girl who was wearing a Coachella t-shirt. Professor Stillman's expression made it clear he had no idea what Coachella was. "It's like Woodstock," the girl explained, "except with cool music." Ordinarily, Stillman would have refused, but he looked out at the clear blue sky and at the piercing sunshine. "All right," he said, "let's do this." The class was Introduction to Shakespeare, and the text was the first part of Henry IV, a history play about the heir to the throne, Prince Hal, successfully defeats a rebellion headed by Hotspur, a rebel who dies on the battlefield. Stillman was discussing Hotspur's last words, which he never gets a chance to say. "That's what's interesting about them," Stillman told his students. "Fatally wounded, on the battlefield, Hotspur dies mid-sentence. That's what death is," Stillman told his students. "It's not being allowed to get to the end of your sentence." He looked up then and saw his students were listening. Ordinarily, inside, in the classroom, they would have their MacBooks open, be checking emails or updating their Facebook statuses. But not now. Now they were sitting up and paying attention, just when he least expected it. "Are you, like, having a seizure?" his student Henry asked him. "I'm fine," said Stillman, and it was like he was waking up. Then he opened his book and read from the play. "These," he told the class, "are Hotspur's last words." He read from the text. "Oh, I could prophesy, but that the earthly and cold hand of death lies on my tongue. No, Percy, thou art dust and food for..." And all at once, Professor Stillman stopped. "What happened?" said the girl in the Coachella shirt. "What's next?" "Hotspur dies," Stillman told her. "That's what's next. Hotspur dies, and instead of saying his last words, it's Hal, his enemy, who finishes it for him. Thou art dust, says Hal, and food for worms." "That is so raw," said Henry. "Was anyone not thinking worms?" said another student. "I was thinking fish," said the girl in the Coachella shirt. "Thou art dust and food for fish." "Maybe sharks," said the other student. "That would make more sense. Thou art dust and food for sharks." "Except sharks don't really eat dust," said Stillman. "Hello," said Henry. "Neither do worms." "The point," said Stillman, "is that for Shakespeare, when you die, you don't get to tell the story. You don't get to write the history. You don't get to finish the sentence." "Very heavy," said Henry. "Very heavy indeed." It was, perhaps, the finest moment of Stillman's teaching career. Caught up in the momentum, Stillman took a deep breath as if to go on. "If you remember one thing from this class," he heard himself say, at that very moment, a very small piece of a very large satellite fell out of the sky. "If you remember one thing about this class," he said, and then the satellite hit him on the side of the head, just above his left ear. It knocked him instantaneously unconscious. When Stillman came to, he found himself staring up at the clear blue sky. I totally thought he was food for worms, Stillman heard a student say. They helped him sit up, and someone gave him a bottle of water. Professor Stillman looked around at the concerned faces of his students. Someone handed him the chunk of satellite, and he slowly turned the charred metal around in his hands. Once, he imagined, the satellite had been as big as a sailboat, though the rest of it had burned up after entering the atmosphere. This was all that remained, and somehow it had found Stillman. He passed it to his student Henry, who contemplated it in a kind of awed silence, handing it, after a minute, to the girl in the Coachella shirt. No one said anything. And all at once, Professor Stillman found himself not caring about not remembering what he'd been about to say. This was teaching. He knew that no matter where his students would boldly go after this, no matter who they became or what tragedies would befall them, that they would remember this day when the satellite fell from the sky. He was not food for worms, not entirely anyway. Some part of him had cracked the atmosphere, made it all the way to the very surface of the Earth. You're listening to Off Topic. I'm Steve Hayward.
I'm Kathy Jaffray, and this week we're talking about space exploration. And you know, Steve, in the past week I've been mesmerized by these videos from Chris Hadfield, who is an astronaut who was on the International Space Station. He just landed, actually. His mission is over just this week. And he's really been getting a lot of excitement. His videos have gone viral all over the web, doing simple things like, you know, wringing out a washcloth in space. Have you seen these?
The question is, if you get a cloth dripping wet without gravity and you wring it out, what's going to happen?
Shaving in space takes a little more care because your whiskers could float off and they'll end up, you'll breathe them and they'll get into the computers and everything. So here's a common question. Can you cry in space? Do tears work?
I have seen them. Have you seen the one where he plays that David Bowie song?
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Lock your Soyuz hatch and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom.
Ordinarily, we would not bring to the attention of our listenership something as pedestrian as an amateurish version of David Bowie's Space Oddity, but this one is in space. It's by a cool Canadian astronaut in space.
And a cool Canadian itself. Very strange. Very odd.
This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade. And the papers want...
I find it a little disturbing. I find it a little disconcerting.
Why?
He's up in space. Doesn't he have anything better to do? Aren't there more important things to do than play
Steve,
David Bowie songs?
Steve, this is the thing that's going on that I think is so exciting here, which is he's really reignited the excitement and the coolness and the wonder of space exploration, of being out in space for kids. Little kids, that really hasn't existed since the end of the Apollo program.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills. Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone, and one we intend to win. And the others too.
But things have changed since then. And I went recently to the Space Symposium here in Colorado Springs, and I was struck by how much they'd changed. We had the Apollo program, we had the shuttle program, which in some way anesthetized the public to the idea of being in space.
Well, I think it became routine to go to space. It was something that people did all the time, it seemed. It wasn't something like when I was a girl that we would stay up late at night to watch a rocket launch or a landing. Now it seemed like kind of you might stumble across it on your trip to Disney World.
All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
I sat down with Dr. Sandy Magnus. She's a former astronaut. She was on the last shuttle mission. She was on the International Space Station for 4.5 months. She's very much a transitional figure, about poised, as it were, between what the space program used to be and where it's going now. Tell us a little bit about how the space program has changed during the time that you've been involved in it.
When I first got to NASA, of course, we were building the International Space Station, and that took some time.
Yes.
And we've just finished that, so now we have a fully operational national laboratory, and that, I think, is a very big milestone in what we're doing in space. We've had people living in space continuously on the space station from the year 2000, and I think that's a pretty interesting factoid, if you will. But we're kind of at an interesting juncture in the space program mm-hmm. right now, because we've gotten to the point where there's enough knowledge and experience in working in low Earth orbit that private enterprises are starting to get interested in
right.
it for commercial purposes. And so when you think about what the role of a government is supposed to be playing, you know, the government agencies do the hard things, the things that, quite frankly, you don't have to make a profit on, because
right,
that's
right.
not the, you know, so the long-term hard slog to break down barriers into new areas, economic, geographic, whatever. And so it's taken some time with space, because it's a little hard to get there, and it's
yeah.
a little bit more capital intensive to move into that area. But we're now at a place in history where we've got enough momentum, and there's enough understanding of the risk involved and enough understanding of the potential, that now private industry is starting to move in that direction. And so it's sort of a turning point, if you will. You think
yeah.
about the first forays across the oceans, you know, with the exploration ships and how
sure.
long that took that to happen. So it's an interesting time we live in, and that will allow the government, you know, to push that forward, that boundary forward,
yeah.
you know, that slog, break down a new barrier as private enterprise and commercial interests roll into low Earth orbit. So it's kind of an interesting paradigm shift from that viewpoint.
Is that a new thing, the move in of private enterprise, or is that in some way always been a part of it, always been part of where it's going?
Well, we've certainly been trying to get there for a long time. I think what you see differently here, and I'm speaking specifically about manned space,
sure.
like, 'cause, you know, the satellite world has already shifted this way a little bit, and we're kind of climbing up the difficulty trail.
Mm-hmm.
But you have now an environment where commercial enterprises will provide services to the government and then potentially exploit that same capability for their own purposes, where in the past, the government's been intimately involved in creating the vehicles and the things that we're going to do, and therefore, by nature of that, that capability was not available for other people to exploit in other
mm-hmm.
ways. So it's a little bit of a shift on how we're approaching it, and it's started the slow turnover of the low Earth orbit to commercial, but it's only the beginning of it. It could still take some time to complete that shift.
So it seems to me, in a lot of ways, we're still in the infancy of space exploration, not too far from that 1492 moment. Looking out now over the next, say, 20, 30 years, what kinds of initiatives are we going to see?
Wow, you know, that's a tough one to look into the crystal ball and see where we're at. I think you will see more and more industry getting interested in low Earth orbit. There's strong potential there for the pharmaceutical industry and the people who are trying to understand
sure.
biological mechanisms. I think that's probably, from a commercial viewpoint, the leading edge of the spear. As far as where the government chooses to go next, there's a very lively debate going on between asteroids, moon, and Mars. How fast commercial can come into low Earth orbit really depends upon what each of the business plans are that these different companies have and what opportunities present themselves. There's certainly tourism. Is a factor. You know, research capability for pharmaceuticals, I think, has some potential. There's some people who are very interested in satellite repair.
Right.
And we've got a lot of satellites up there that have run out of fuel, and they're just sort of slowly decaying. If you can go up somehow and figure out how to fix that, whether it's with humans or robots, that's a potential discussion point. There's people worried about planetary defense with some of the asteroid cases,
mm-hmm.
and whether that turns into a business or not, I don't know, but there's certainly some interest there. So the landscape's wide open. It means there's a lot of opportunities out there.
For some people listening, they may understand this as more of a contradiction between exploration and exploitation.
No, they're not a contradiction. They're two separate things.
Right.
You know, exploitation is what we're talking about, and I don't mean that in a negative sense, but as you move into an environment of low Earth orbit, it's being utilized in a way that the government doesn't do. The government's into exploration. You know, and the fact that we live at this transition point where we're still using government money to help encourage, it's like seed money, if you will, in a way that's different than exploration. So the real crux of the arguments or the debates that are taking place are how much do you use government funding in a limited resource environment? How much of that limited resource goes to seeding the utilization of low Earth orbit versus how much of that seed money goes to continuing to push those boundaries out and do the exploration piece? So the real tension is in the distribution of the resources between those two, complementary.
Competing.
They're not competing. They're complementary in strategic, in the strategic sense. Their intention in a limited resource world. So I guess if you can say there's any competition, it's there, but I don't think of it as competition. I think of it as, what is our strategic plan for the use and the development of humans in space in general and how we're going to use it? But so that's really what you see is two complementary functions being forced to be in tension a little bit because of a limited resource budget.
So let me start by being extremely clear. I am 100% committed to the mission of NASA and its future. Because broadening our capabilities in space will continue to serve our society in ways that we can scarcely imagine. Because exploration will once more inspire wonder in a new generation, sparking passions and launching careers. And because ultimately, if we fail to press forward in the pursuit of discovery, we are seeding our future and we are seeding that essential element of the American character.
From the time that you decided that you might want to be an astronaut to now, how has your view of space changed since that time where, you know, space was that place where you would boldly go someday, where no one has gone before? Now that you've spent months in space, does that change your perception of what space is?
I don't think it changes my perception of what space is, because I would go again in a heartbeat because it's just really that much fun.
Is it that cool?
Oh my gosh, it's an amazing thing to live on the space station like I got to do for 4.5 months, and my life ruled by Newton's laws, and I had this lovely view of our planet out the window doing all this great science. I mean, it's just spectacular.
Yeah.
So that part hasn't changed. I think what's really changed or what I've had a chance to perceive differently is our planet. And you know this intellectually, everyone who's listening knows this intellectually, how thin our atmosphere is.
Yeah.
You know, when you think about people climbing Mount Everest and they're in oxygen masks and it's only 29,000 feet or something like that, and the circumference of the Earth is 25,000 miles plus some change. So it's really just skinny, tiny little eggshell thin atmosphere. When you see it, it really hits you. Oh my gosh, this planet is our spaceship. It's this tiny, bright little blue marble with these wonderful landscapes and so much blue and white with the clouds and the ocean, and this tiny little layer of air that protects us all. It really makes you think. And then the other thing that I like to share this is my perception of gravity is completely different than your perception of gravity.
In what way?
You've always lived in gravity. You don't understand that if you're just moving your arm around, you are working really, really hard. I feel gravity as this horrible, monstrous, nasty force that's trying to squish me like a bug on the planet.
Is that right? So you got back and you were like, man, gravity is a drag.
Exactly. And I remember thinking, even after my first mission, it was only 10 or 11 days, it's like, oh my gosh, I can't believe we can even move down here. I mean, it's just amazing how horrible gravity is.
I've read where you've said that eventually you get used to not experiencing gravity, where you wake up in the morning and you don't think about how there's no gravity, essentially how adaptable humans are. But was there anything you didn't get used to when you were in space?
Well, you know, because you adapt. I will tell you, though, I missed being able to go outside. I had these wonderful views of the planet, and I wouldn't have changed them for a world. But sometimes, I mean, don't take for granted the ability that you can go outside and you can feel the breeze on your face. Or you can go outside and you feel the heat of the sun warming you up. Or you can go outside and you can smell the smell of the earth. These are things that you should not take for granted, and those are the things that I miss.
You know, I think in our imaginations, I know for me at least, I've spent a lot of time imagining space and imagining myself in space. And I'm wondering, as compared to something like Battlestar Galactica, how is actually being in space different than what we see portrayed on television or in film?
Okay, so the biggest thing about being in space is the fact that it's great to be without gravity, but you gotta watch your stuff. Things float off. I had to have zippers in my pockets, so things wouldn't float out of my pocket.
Is that really just sort of float?
They
right
just float
out.
Right out. Think about how many times you've walked around your house, and your hands were full, and you was like, "Oh, I forgot. You know, I forgot the tablet in the kitchen." And so you put stuff down in your hands, and you put them on a shelf, and you walk to the kitchen, you get the tablet, come back. When you come back, all that stuff is still there because gravity's holding it down.
Right.
So living in space, and what they can't portray on TV when you watch shows about space, because they're filming those in gravity, is
right.
The fact that you have to keep track of your stuff all the time because it just floats off. If your hands are full and you need to go do something, you've got to find Velcro, you've got to find some duct tape, you've got to stick it into a crack or something to friction fit it.
Yeah.
You got to put it in your pocket with a zipper. You have to put it behind a bungee. Otherwise, it's gone. How many times have you taken off your glasses and set them on a table and combed your hair? You can't do that. You just simply can't do that. You cannot put stuff down. It alters the way you look at living your life. You can't. You have to fasten, attach, tape, or zip things in place. Ziploc bags, by the way, are very useful.
What do you think is the biggest challenge facing the space program in the 21st century?
The biggest challenge, quite frankly, that we have is a long-term plan. The space program needs a long-term vision that we are allowed to execute and not change course every 2, 4, or 6 years. That's been our problem. We can't seem as a country to get on a path and stay there. Because all the investments that you make in the space program, that we make in the space program, they're by nature long-term investments. And it's hard, in the environment that we live in culturally right now, it's hard to stick to long-term investments in a very short-term attention
And
culture.
Politically shifting culture.
Politically
shifting.
So really the best thing we can do for our space program is give it a 20-year plan and let it execute the 20-year plan.
So if you were to say what a 20-year plan would look like, what would that be?
You continue to seed the utilization of low Earth orbit so that commercial moves into it so NASA can push the next boundary, and the next boundary gets NASA out of low Earth orbit into the next destination. I think Mars is the ultimate destination.
In what sense? In terms of colonization?
Exploration. We're talking about exploration, remember, because the utilization is going to come up in low Earth orbit. And so what we have to do is go out to explore. There's a couple of moons that are interesting, Io and Europa, that we're examining. But if there are potential signs of life on Mars, and now we think there's water there, and Mars Curiosity is going to give us some great data about what other kinds of resources are on Mars, and perhaps that would be a good place to go investigate or explore next.
Now, when you talk about Io and Europa, what's interesting about those moons?
There's water. You follow the water, right?
Follow the water.
And we're finding that there's more than we thought out there,
and
those are natural places to go, because ideally wherever you go, whether people talk about the moon or Mars, or whether you go to the Mars via the moon, and there's different ways you can get there. It makes a lot of sense to do some of this technology testing in our backyard, which is the moon. But when you go to the place that you want to go to, you want to be able to use the resources there and sort of live off the land to the greatest extent possible.
Right. Yeah.
And so sending the Mars, the Spirit, the Opportunity, the Curiosity, and some of the other probes that are heading that way are all reconnaissance flights. And they were originally planned to be reconnaissance flights in the strategic formulation that was made, and eventually maybe bring back some samples so we can understand what's there, because the more that we can use the resources of whatever place we go, the better off we can be, because you can't carry 2 years worth of food with you. You can't carry, 2 years worth of oxygen. I guess you can, but it's not a good solution to the engineering problem of how to send humans further out into the solar system. And we need to do that. So wherever the destination is, the 20-year, 30-year, 40-year, 100-year plan will be keep pushing the boundaries of where humans can go in the solar system.
And you'd go back?
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Dr. Sandy Magnus, terrific discussion. Really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Happy to be here.
This is Off Topic. I'm Kathy Jaffray.
I'm Steve Hayward.
Coming up next, we talk to Dr. Jeffrey Landis, NASA scientist and award-winning science fiction author, about his role in Mars exploration.
And later on in the show, we speak to author P.J. O'Rourke about where we've been and where we're going in terms of space exploration. Stay with us. Off Topic, I'm Steve Hayward.
I'm Kathy Jaffray.
This is the space episode. We're talking about the past and the future of the space program. And when you think about what's next in terms of space exploration, the answer is not, or not anymore, the moon. Think about the moon. We've been there. We've done that. The moon is so 1970s. The moon is yesterday's news. What's next is Mars. Everybody wants to go to Mars, to the red planet. And so we think about who could we speak to about Mars? Who knows Mars? The answer is Dr. Jeffrey Landis. Not only is Dr. Landis a scientist with NASA, he's an award-winning science fiction writer. We thought he would give us a unique perspective into the zeitgeist of space, about the gestalt of getting there. So we gave him a call. I was just at the Space Symposium talking to everybody about space exploration versus space exploitation. Is it your sense, you've been involved with NASA now, more than 20 years, I suppose, right?
Yeah, I've been here for, I guess, 25 years now.
What's your sense of it? Are we at a different moment in the history of space exploration?
Well, space exploration and exploitation have always gone together. Space, in fact, is big business. Space is really a multi-billion-dollar mission. So what's happening now is it looks like people are looking for more applications for space. And they're certainly out there. It's going to be pretty tricky, and I expect there will be some companies that come out and succeed, and there will be some that fail. But it's a lot of opportunities that are kind of waiting around the wings.
I wanted to ask you about your article about that you published, I guess it's, you know, now more than 20 years ago, The Footsteps to Mars. And I wanted to ask you about the lesson of Apollo. If you accomplish your goal, your budget will get cut. How do you think how does that figure into the future of the space program?
Yeah, I think that was just the great disappointment of the Apollo program from a sort of a public standpoint, is it was a tremendous success. The Apollo program did everything that it had promised.
Yeah.
It was just tremendously technologically successful. And the end result was people said, okay, you did it. We're cutting the budget now.
So right.
It's a real sort of conundrum. How do we people that are really interested in not just going out and visiting space, but going out and making a place that we can live, that human beings can settle, how do we make it something that we don't go out and say, okay, we've been there, we've done that, we can go back home now? And I don't know if that problem is solved.
So the lesson of Apollo is to avoid the three Fs, flag, footprints, and forget it. That you get there, and then that's it. The mission accomplished, no more investment, no more interest.
It's been sort of an example that we can look at is Antarctica. That
yeah.
After the first great expeditions, after the pole was reached and the trans-Antarctic expedition went out and tried to cross it and actually failed, Shackleton. Then the question is, you know, what happened then? And the answer is, well, very slowly people eventually went back and started establishing bases, mostly with the International Geophysical Year. But it wasn't a thing that they went and made a mission to the South Pole, and then the next thing we knew, all sorts of people were going to Antarctica. It didn't happen. To a large extent, what we really need from space is not the equivalent of explorers, but we want the equivalent of the Transcontinental Railroad, which was the system that really opened up the whole continent. But the problem is, and this is what we learned from the shuttle, is we can have a great machine that goes into space and makes it routine. And the problem with the shuttle was it was routine. Nobody cared. We were putting together an infrastructure, and people don't care. So those are sort of the two horns of the dilemma. If you go out and do spectacle things, like the Apollo landings, people say, great, we've done that. We can quit now. On the other hand, if you do sort of the bricklaying, piece by piece, putting together an infrastructure, it's boring and nobody cares. So how do you solve that problem? It's a tough question.
So what if you were to forecast, like looking out 20, 30, 50 years, what do you see as being the future of the space program, of space exploration, space commercialism?
Well, of course, there's the future of my dreams and also the future that we're likely to see. The future could go either direction. What I would really love to see is some of the new companies that are looking at new approaches to launching into space, stimulating a revolution. And space travel becomes less expensive, which means that we start going more places and more people and possibly private industry and nonprofit institutes all go out into space, and it bootstraps up into a global infrastructure that can take us off of the planet and eventually move us toward living and working and settling in space.
And the other future?
Well, so far, space is mostly political.
Yeah.
The people who have the money to do large space exploration projects so far have mostly been governments. And, well, governments are always subject to politics. It would be nice if the politicians got together and said, well, what do we want to do? Do we want to start new wars and, invest in the machinery of destruction? Or do we want to go out into the solar system and be remembered for 1,000 years hence as the people who opened up the solar system? But it's difficult to get politicians to all agree on a goal, I'm afraid.
So. One of the reasons we wanted to talk to you, because not only are you a top flight scientist, you're a top flight science fiction writer.
You
have a huge amount of technical knowledge. You also have a poetic sensibility, a fictional sensibility. And I know I'm a writer myself. And when I'm working, say, on a historical novel, the kind of thing that I look for are these moments where there are gaps, these moments where there are these omissions or absences in the record or absences in what we know about it. And that's a place where, for myself as a fiction writer, that's a moment where my imagination asserts itself. And I'm just wondering about the experience of being on Mars. What are those moments as you've been watching the Mars rovers make their way across the surface of the planet? Have there been those moments which suddenly tripped that fictionalizing, imaginative aspect of you, of your mind?
Well, the most thing that we're beginning to understand is just this vast geological history. That Mars isn't just one place, but it's layers and layers and layers of different places. There is this very acidic ocean that we were looking at Meridiani, but that's not the only Mars. Underneath that, there's older layers. And in the older layers, they're not acidic. Here are the layers where you see these minerals that you've heard people talk about, these phyllosilicate minerals.
Yeah.
Phyllosilicates are clays and mica. And these minerals are not laid down in acidic oceans. These are laid down in oceans much more like what you see on the Earth, in very neutral layers. So we see, physically, we see this layered Mars, that underneath each layer there's an earlier layer. And geologically that corresponds to layers in time. So we're going progressively back further in time to a period when Mars might have had a global ocean, or global meaning a hemispheric ocean, a giant ocean much like the Earth. And that would have been very Earth-like. That would not have been the acidic ocean, which probably is very late in the history of Mars, where it was acidified probably by volcanism, perhaps from the giant Olympus volcanoes and Elysium and some of the other other large volcanoes.
Which I love those names, very mythological sounding.
Yes.
I mean, volcanism makes me think of Spock, but that's that's very humanities of me, I know. There was once a time in space exploration where the discovery of an Earth-like planet was huge news. Now, given the advances in terms of how far we're looking out, it happens pretty much every week. When we think about the question of other life, what does the scientist in you say? Is it going to happen? Is it just a matter of time? What do you think?
Well, the scientist in me has to say, we don't know. Every time I hear these speculations, I keep having a little voice saying, you can't really say that. We don't know enough.
Right.
But we're learning so much more. We're beginning to get statistics about extrasolar planets. And we're beginning to see the Earth-sized planets in the distance. But there's still just so much we don't know. Now, the poet in me, the speculator, says, it's got to be out there. There has to be life out other places in the universe. How could there not be? It's such a huge universe. There's 500 billion stars in our galaxy alone.
And what about when the two sides of you get together, the fiction side of you and the science side of you, and they imagine alien life form, which is both feasible but also poetic. What does that kind of creature look like?
Well, the first thing I realized from looking at life on Earth is that it is always so surprising.
Yeah.
I can't imagine but that extraterrestrial life would be even more surprising and more different than anything that we see on Earth. Of course, we're far more closely related to squids than we are to any possible extraterrestrial life. So I think...
True. Is that true? Is that right?
Yeah, sure.
I know a lot of people who I feel like that must be the case, but to get some scientific grounding for that is wonderful.
But so anything extraterrestrial will have to be just completely amazing from our point of view. It could be just absolutely different. Just interesting to speculate, but I will just bet, I will wager that when we do find extraterrestrial life, it will be even more different than we can imagine.
This is Off Topic. I'm Kathy Jaffray.
I'm Steve Hayward.
And this week we're talking about space.
That's right. And our next person up is Leroy Chow, who's an astronaut, who gives a kind of perspective on where he thought the space program was going.
So, Steve, you're the one who talked to these astronauts. And I'm wondering, what are astronauts, what are they really like?
Well, I think the answer is that they're a little different from the rest of us. They're ordinary people, but they have been somewhere that you will never go, and they know it. And you feel like if you ever got into a real argument with them, that you would be back and forth, but this, and then it would eventually come down to, but have you ever been in space? And that would settle the issue.
You would lose. You lost. Your argument is invalid.
See what you think. Here's Leroy Chow talking about the future of the space program. So tell us a little bit about your involvement in the space program.
Sure. I was a NASA astronaut for 15 years, and I got a chance to fly four missions into space. My first three missions were aboard space shuttles, and on my fourth mission, I flew up and down with the Russians on a Soyuz vehicle and served as the commander, NASA science officer of the International Space Station during Expedition 10, which was a 6.5-month flight.
Walking around the Space Symposium today, I'm struck by the way in which the sense of discovery, the sense of space as being that which is beyond is mixed with a certain amount of expansionism in a different sense, expansionism in a commercial sense. And I wonder about that connection and maybe contradiction between commercialism, between exploration and exploitation. What do you think about the increasing trend of the commercialization of space, the privatization of space exploration?
Well, I think it goes hand in hand. First, you go to explore, right? You go explore, you find, you get access to that place, and then you find things that you can exploit, if you will, to make it commercial, and then you hand it off to the commercial sector. And that's one of the things the Space Foundation Pioneering Report, that's kind of the thrust of what it addresses. So I think it makes perfect sense. We've been going to low Earth orbit for over 50 years, sending astronauts up for over 50 years. So the technology is mature, and it's time to try to transition that to the commercial side. And that will allow NASA and other agencies to focus their resources on going beyond low Earth orbit, pushing out and exploring farther. You know, because if you once you've got the technology mature and the commercial market sees a potential there, they're going to go and try to do it, which is what's happening.
One of the things that we're hearing is that one of the big challenges that faces the space program in the next 20, 30 years is the question of the long-term plan. One of the things that certainly held the space industry back, or space exploration back, is the lack of that long-term vision. If you were to, in a perfect world, or an imperfect world, if you were to, in a different world, if you were to be the one to say, okay, 30 years out, long-term plan, space exploration, space commercialization, what does that look like from your perspective?
Well, first of all, the government program, the exploration program that's not being commercially funded because you can't convince an investor or a group of investors as a return, is to go and explore Mars and land astronauts on Mars and start human exploration on Mars. So that would be going on. In parallel, you've got the commercial development, access to low Earth orbit, sending astronauts to low Earth orbit to space stations and things like that, and even developing commercial space stations to do research and tourism. So I would see the two happening hand in hand, and over the next 30 years, I said 30, 40 years, is it realistic to be able to go to Mars? Well, technically, as far as rockets and propulsion and computers and navigation, we can go to Mars. Obviously, we've landed rovers on Mars. We'd have to develop robust life support systems, thermal control systems, and other things we'd need to add to keep humans alive in order to get humans to the surface of Mars. But it really comes down to a political will and a national or international, in this case, will to go do that and a financial commitment. So, that would be my dream, is that we would find that commitment. And I think one of the ways you do that is, you get international buy-in, that it becomes a common goal, just an international space station became a common goal. And so these countries, politically and with money, were making the commitment to make it a reality. And so that would be the model for beyond low Earth orbit exploration, including going to Mars.
Listen, fascinating talking to you. Thank you so much for spending the time with us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks.
It has come to our attention that a mysterious force is loose somewhere in outer space.
The mysteries of creation are there.
Up in the sky?
Up in the sky.
The moon and the planets are there. And new hopes for knowledge and peace are there. And therefore, as we set sail, we ask God's blessing on the most hazardous and dangerous and greatest adventure on which man has ever embarked.
You're listening to Off Topic. I'm Kathy Giffray.
I'm Steve Hayward. And later on in the show, we speak to author, journalist, space enthusiast PJ O'Rourke about his thoughts on space exploration. Stay with us.
This is Off Topic. I'm Kathy Jaffray.
I'm Steve Hayward.
And this week we're talking about space exploration.
Next up is P.J. O'Rourke.
You know, I think of P.J. O'Rourke as an author, as the author of Parliament of Whores and Holidays in Hell. But as it turns out, he's also, what I didn't know, a space enthusiast.
It's true. We ran into him at the Space Symposium. He's actually on the board of directors of the National Space Foundation. And he has some very interesting, some very provocative views about where the space program is going and where it should be going.
One of the things we're struck by as we walk around the Space Symposium is the mix of commercialism and exploration that we see at the Space Symposium. What do you make of this mix between entrepreneurship and exploration?
It's a mix that doesn't stand up to inspection very well. What you will find when you talk to the people on the commercial side of this, a lot of them come out of the non-commercial side of it. Tremendous number of them are ex-military. What they all are is enthusiasts. This is really enthusiasm-driven. Money is made, but the enthusiasm is uniform. And leaving aside such things as feeding the family, if you were to tap anybody over there, top CEO, you know, on down to the newest executive on the private side, and said, "Look, if you enlist in the Air Force, you get to go on the Mars mission." You know, they'd be so out of there. Yeah. You know, they would kiss that salary goodbye. You know, and assuming the spouse doesn't kill them.
Talk a little bit about the space shuttle and what that vehicle means to you, how it lives in your imagination.
Well, it lives in my imagination, I mean, partly in a romantic way, you know, to see the last one go up and to know this was an end of an era. On the other hand, it was, as a piece of technology, it was highly imperfect. And so I feel no regret, really, for the end of the space shuttle program, except where was its replacement? You know, where was the next shuttle, which should have been ready to go by the time the last one left? That leaves a hole in my heart, you know. And I had my little kid there. I took my 9-year-old son to see the last shuttle launch. And I was explaining to him about the end of the space shuttle program. And he said, "You mean we can't get up there?" I said, "Well, we can. We just have to depend on the Russians." Even at 8, he's not an enthusiast for the Russians. And he said, "You mean we can't get up there ourselves?" And when he actually got to meet an astronaut, that was the first thing he said, was, we can't get up there. And the astronaut kind of said, "We'll be back. We've got this program and that program, you know, and in 2020, so on." And my kid was having none of it, and he said, "But we can't get up there." And the astronaut looked out over the top of my kid's head to me, you know, we made eye contact over the kid's head, you know, and that's what the astronaut was feeling too,
you know. You know, maybe one of the things that the space program would benefit from most greatly in this country is having a long-term plan, a mission that looked out 30, maybe 40 years, irrespective of political changes. Do you think that's the case?
Absolutely. We need a goal. We need a goal, and it needs to be a good one. It can't be a Lagrange point. Whatever that may be, the place in between the Earth and the Moon where the gravity is equal and you can hang a space station, you know, and sort of, that isn't going to grab the public imagination. We need to go to Mars. We need to go to Venus. Capture an asteroid is pretty good. Have your own pet asteroid. Capture an asteroid. Bring it back to Earth orbit. Play with it, you know, build things on it. You know, I can see that, you know. It doesn't necessarily have to be even a manned mission. I mean, look at Mars. You know, you can get people really excited with robotic stuff too. And I don't think we have to be racing against anybody, but I'll tell you what would open everybody's eyes and get everybody's attention back is not when, not if, but when the Chinese land on the moon. People are going to go, "Wait a minute, you know, what have we been doing?" You know? But still, I don't think we have to put it in those terms. It wasn't the Cold War that made our first trip to the moon so exciting. I wasn't standing there when I was watching that television as an adult hippie that thought he hated everything about the United States and was so gobsmacked by that. I wasn't thinking Cold War. You know, I think I was at that stage of youthful politics where I don't think I believed the Cold War existed. They were just all fascist pigs. It wasn't the Cold War that was holding my attention with that. It was just the we went to the moon. I mean, just how cool is that?
I wonder if I could, the emotional impact of seeing something leave the planet. There is some kind of human response that we have to that, of watching something lift off. Is that the romance of space?
You bet it is. You know, I mean, it is the sheer power that it takes for us to escape our quotidian environment, to see that power in action, to watch that rocket take off, even a smaller launch, even just for a satellite, that's a very powerful thing. And then there is this, you know, this flatland we live in. You know, most of the time we're not thinking that we're on a planet. You know, we're just on a piece of ground, and we're not thinking about the fact that we're traveling through space and that our whole universe is also traveling through space and just how much of all that's out there. And it, you know, when we're 10 or so and we first learn about this, 8, 9, 10, it gives us a sense of wonder. But we don't carry that sense of wonder around with us very often. And when you see the launch, it all comes back. All of a sudden, the 8-year-old and everybody is, you know, we're on a planet. The planet's not, it's round. It goes around the sun, and the whole solar system goes around the galaxy, and the galaxy is traveling through space. Wow. You know, and it brings all the wow back.
Listen, PJ Rourke, wonderful talking to you. Thanks for taking the time.
Oh, not at all. No.
A rat done bit my sister Nell with Whitey on the moon. Her face and arms began to swell, and Whitey's on the moon. I can't pay no doctor bills, but Whitey's on the moon. 10 years from now, I'll be paying still while Whitey's on the moon. You know,
I'm Steve Hayward. This is Off Topic.
I'm Kathy Jaffray.
You know, what is Chris Hadfield doing? Is that the shape of our imagination now? A YouTube video in which Chris Hadfield plays an ancient David Bowie song. Is that the future of space exploration?
But I think you short sell Chris Hadfield by putting it that way, because I think the thing he's doing is saying that space isn't something that's so disconnected from all of us down here on Earth. That, you know, he's answering questions that kids are sending in. He's saying, look, really cool things are happening up here. And you know, this is not dry and boring science. This is something that fires the human imagination. And that excitement about exploration, which maybe had withered a little bit as space became routine, maybe it's time to inject some of that excitement, some of that newness back into how we think about what's going on in space.
This is a chastening thought. The space program is exactly as old as I am. And I guess that we're asking the same things about the space program as one asks at 43 about oneself. Am I still sexy? Is anybody still interested? Is there anywhere yet to go? And the answer, Kathy, I think, is an emphatic yes.
Still exciting. Off Topic is produced by Craig Richardson and Jake Brownell, with help from the Tim Gill Center for Public Media, a part of Rocky Mountain PBS, in association with Colorado College and KRCC in Colorado Springs.
For more information or to download any of our episodes, to download any part of this episode that you might have missed, or to send us a large sandwich with salami on it, you can find us at www.offtopicradio.org. I'm Steve Hayward.
I'm Kathy Jaffray.
And until next week, stay off topic.